Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You know those really old sepia-colored team photographs on the school wall? The ones where they only show the five members of the football team's offensive line? How everything looks so outdated, the uniforms don't fit, the pads are bulky, and all the boys have their hair parted in the middle. Well, now look at the bottom of the photograph. 1945, it says. And check out the names of the players. The Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, China, and the United States. Champions then of the Second World War. And for the last 58 years, the unrivaled permanent members of the UN Security Council. For years, people have argued that the team picture is outdated. Tom Friedman's the latest with his cheeky notion to vote France off the island. But in fact, there is a long and very serious history of attempts to change the makeup and membership of the Security Council. But like the aging athletes they are, the original five would rather keep the team as it is. Recently, there's been talk of adding India to the picture, a democracy with more than a billion people. Another voice from Asia. It sounds good, but then it gets very complicated. What about Africa? What about Latin America? And what about the veto? Connection listeners, is it time to redesign the Security Council, to hold new tryouts for those permanent member seats? Everyone's arguing about the relevance of the UN. Can it be altered to make it more representative of the current geopolitical realities? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us today is Saugata Bose. He's professor of history and chairman of the Committee on South Asian Studies at Harvard University. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
And from his office in New York, Professor Edward Luck, director of the Center on International Organization at Columbia University and an expert on UN reform efforts. Hello, Professor Luck.
Hello.
I'm going to start with you because I understand that as recently as this past October, a UN committee was again closeted behind a closed door and talking again about Security Council reform. Why don't they ever get anywhere with that?
Well, the General Assembly has had a committee since 1994 that's been pretty continuously looking at this question. But I think it has a lot to do with the nature of the organization. When you have 191 member states from all over the world with very diverse interests, one of the things they have the hardest time agreeing on is who should decide, who should be in charge. Each region, each major player somehow has a different design than someone else. So everyone is in favor of reform. Almost everyone says that the council should be changed, but they each have their own particular view of what that ought to be, and it becomes very, very difficult to negotiate any change that can work. And also you have a rather high hurdle in the charter in terms of how you amend the charter, which it would require to change those names or change the numbers or the way they make decisions in the council. You have to get two-thirds of the member states voting in the General Assembly, and then you have to get them to ratify this in their national parliaments or through their national procedures. And on top of that, those ratifying it must include all five permanent members, none of whom are eager to either to give up their seats or to have more permanent members.
But help me with my history here, because if we go back to 1965, the last time the Security Council actually changed shape, going from 11 to 15 members, at that time, if I understand it correctly, the five permanent members, none of them agreed until all the other nations started voting, and then they reluctantly, one by one, all ratified it.
That's basically what happened. In the original vote, an expansion of ECOSOC, the Economic and Social Council, was attached to an expansion of the Security Council. And none of the five agreed to both. China, which of course at that point was Taipei in the UN, did go along with the Security Council expansion, but not the other expansion. But you're right, the U.S., which had been dead against this particular expansion, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, they all, one after another, like so many dominoes, went along because I guess the pressure just became too much. It was during the middle of the Cold War, and the Soviets went first, of course, seeking favor in the Third World, and the U.S. in the end didn't want to be the last one standing to block this change, because after all, the U.N. had changed enormously. It had increased an enormous number of developing countries, particularly from Africa and Asia, and the majority of the membership were from those two regions by that point, and they were badly underrepresented in the Council.
Shugata Bose, what's the reason why the UN Security Council permanent membership really needs to be changed at this point? What's your thought on that?
Well, in 1945, it was the victors of the Second World War who occupied those five seats. And since then, of course, a very large number of countries in Asia and Africa have won independence. The process of decolonization began with the Philippines in 1946, followed by India and Pakistan in 1947. And none of the countries that won independence after the Second World War has representation, permanent representation on the Security Council. And I think that, you know, we have left four decades of the Cold War behind us. There are new kinds of threats to security, challenges to security, issues of poverty and development that are best understood by the countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America are inextricably linked with security issues. And therefore, it seems to me that these countries deserve permanent representation. And India, I think, is an important enough country to be able to parley on equal terms with the rich and powerful, who presently are the permanent members of the Security Council, but also has the potential to be a representative voice of the developing world as a whole, not just of Asia, but perhaps also for Africa and Latin America. I'm only sorry that the issue has come up in rather unfortunate circumstances. It seems to have been raised in the American media as a stick with which to beat France. Now, ironically, France is one of the five permanent members
which supports an Indian claim. Does Russia, as does Great Britain.
That's right. And even China has said that they understand India's credentials as a big country with more than a billion people to stake a claim for permanent membership. It is the United States, really, which has so far been non-committal. However, relations between India and the United States has generally improved during the last decade, and therefore a serious consideration of India's candidacy is not beyond the realm of possibility. It's never easy to change a status quo, but at least it is something that can be seriously debated at this point.
And Ed Luck, where do you begin? Do you begin by saying we preserve the veto of the original five, or we get rid of the veto? Or do you begin by saying we need to do this geographically, or do you begin by saying we need to do this democratically? How do you start?
Well, my own preference would be not to have additional countries with a veto, because in essentially what you do is you narrow more and more which geographical areas and on which issues the Council can act. Because the more countries that can say no, the less room there is for the Council really to maneuver. And in fact, when I worked on the efforts in the General Assembly with the President of the General Assembly, Razali Ismail, with his proposal in 1997, one of the things in his proposal was that the new permanent members would not get the veto, but the current ones would be encouraged to only use the veto on Chapter 7 measures, that is, those having to do with economic or military coercion. But on other matters, for example, the selection of the Secretary General and other things, that they should refrain from using their veto power. The problem, what we end up with, is it would be nice to design a global formula. And it also would be nice to pick a particular deserving state here or there. But the problem is the main opposition comes from within the regions. It's not a north-south issue primarily.
I mean, this is Pakistan arguing against India or other Latin American countries arguing against Brazil, that kind of opposition?
Exactly, and very strongly Italy versus Germany. The Italians were just completely against having Germany have a third permanent seat from Western Europe, and they be left behind because they consider Europe to have four major powers. Pakistan and Italy worked together to try to block the reform on any issue, not only this issue, because Pakistan so much wanted to block the possibility of India, which was one of the most likely candidates to get a permanent seat, and the Italians were so likely to try to block the Germans. So you get these odd combinations, which politically you wouldn't think that Pakistan and Italy had a great deal in common, but they each wanted to be sure that the local hegemon, the local great power, wouldn't be getting any additional recognition through this. And the Africans at one point wanted three permanent seats because they had obviously a number of candidates between Egypt and Nigeria and South Africa and potentially others. So it's a very, very complicated thing. And to say it's just poor countries of the South versus the U.S. and others blocking this, unfortunately, isn't really the way it works.
Professor Bose, though, would it make much difference to create, say, another five permanent members of the Security Council to give India and other countries those seats without the veto power? Because there is that, you know, the ability for all countries to bicycle their way through the Security Council as exists right now. What difference would it make to be permanent without the veto?
Well, I don't think it would help very much to have a tier of second-class permanent members of the Security Council. I think Professor Luck has a point when he says that it might be best to bring about a diminution of the exercise of the veto power of even the existing members and limit that to very key issues of economic and military coercion. And then bring about some degree of balance. Now, of course, the veto power is, in fact, something that is most treasured by the current permanent members mm-hmm. of the Security Council. And it would not make very much sense to have permanency without some degree of an equal voice. So if it is impossible to give the new entrants the full veto powers, perhaps what one should look at is how to, in fact, reduce the scope of the veto power of all permanent members. Now, you were talking about the difficulty in the regions. And yes, there is no agreement, for example, in Africa in terms of who might be the permanent member of the Security Council if the UN went the route of regional representation. Mm-hmm. And there are, of course, local difficulties in South Asia as well. To my mind, it would seem to me that, you know, India's case would be immeasurably strengthened if it adopted a more imaginative and generous policy towards its neighbors, if it tried to mend fences with its neighbors. It's important for India also to rise above its subcontinental difficulties, not get mired in them, if it really wants to realize its ambition of playing a role on the global stage.
So if India was granted the status of permanent member status, it might be a little bit more willing to look at some kind of negotiated settlement for Kashmir, a little bit more inclined to improve relationship with
yes,
Pakistan?
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting, that a carrot of a permanent seat on the UN Security Council might prove to be an incentive or an inducement to India to, for example, address rather than evade the Kashmir issue. There are those in India who feel that India has a role to play in the world, on the global stage, therefore they should not be caught in the difficulties of the subcontinent and rise above them.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, is some significant reform of the Security Council at the United Nations necessary? Keep that institution as relevant as everybody says it should be, particularly at this time. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Well, what about it? Reform of the United Nations. A dream, a fantasy, something that could actually happen. With me on the program today, Edward Luck, Professor of Practice in International and Public Affairs, Director of the Center on International Organization at Columbia University, and lots of years of experience in dealing specifically and directly inside the UN with the reform process. Sugata Bose is with me here in the studio. He's professor of history and chairman of the Committee on South Asian Studies at Harvard, author of a book called The Indian Ocean Rim, an Interregional Arena in the Age of Global Empire. We should probably talk Shugata, about whether or not this is a good time to be even having the conversation. At a time of crisis, should we be setting all notions of reform to one side, or is this a good time to talk about it?
As Professor Luck said, there has been a committee looking into this issue from 1994 onwards, but it is something that falls out of the public debate very easily. This is a moment when the world's attention is focused on the role of the Security Council on a weighty matter of war and peace. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think while minds are focused on the role that the Security Council can play or ought to play, it is a good idea to, you know, raise this issue for broader public discussion. And I really do think that there are countries from the developing world, such as India, which might actually be able to bring a new kind of perspective to the Security Council about what kinds of interventions in different parts of the world are actually likely to work in the long term and what might in fact be counterproductive. And that is a kind of voice that really needs to be heard. During the Cold War, the main threat to security came from the rivalry between the two major power blocs. Mm-hmm. But today, that security challenges come from elsewhere. And so there does need to be sort of an informed perspective. You know, a country like India, for example, quite apart from being a democracy for the last 50 years, having more than a billion people, a very diverse population and so forth, has taken part in all but one of the peacekeeping operations of the UN. That's the kind of, voice that you have to hear on, in fact, a continuing basis in the United Nations. And therefore, I do think it's a good time to at least talk about it. It is a dream in the sense that it will not be easily achievable, but one ought to push for it at moments such as this.
Ed, like, you're on the Security General's Policy Working Group on the United Nations and terrorism. I know that you've done a lot of work with reform. In fact, Kofi Annan was favored as Secretary General because of his tendency toward reform. Is this a moment to take a look at some of the old and calcified failings of the permanent membership?
Well, I think it's always a good time to review what the Council is doing. Does it have credibility? Does it have real legitimacy? I'd have to say this is also a somewhat awkward time. Particularly for India. One, because of the problems it's had continually with Pakistan and some of the internal problems it's had, some people would see a U.S.-Indian sort of coalition in on some of these issues as being sort of anti-Islamic in intent. Second of all, as Professor Bose pointed out, India does have a different perspective on intervention, but it's been particularly negative about the idea of humanitarian intervention, which, of course, in areas like Rwanda and the Balkans, Kosovo, has been an important part of the UN's repertoire in recent years, not always with positive experience. But it brings a particular perspective which is not very positive towards an activist council in these areas. And third is the question of the acquisition of nuclear weapons. I mean, it's unfortunate that the five permanent members for a long time were the only admitted nuclear weapons powers. But so soon after India and Pakistan went nuclear, some people would think the symbolism would be wrong to say, oh, now that you have nuclear weapons, now come become a permanent member. So, I would encourage this debate, and I think India has a lot of very important attributes to bring to the Council. But the idea of whether it should be brought on as a permanent member and then it would resolve its regional problems, I think that may be putting the cart before the horse. Maybe the foreign policy should change first, and I think it is moving in what I would consider to be encouraging directions, but I think more needs to be done. For example, India has been dead set against having the question of Kashmir considered by the UN, and it is one of the powder kegs in the world that the Council ought to be addressing, but they've been completely negative. Now, if something can be done about Kashmir, if something can be done about politics and relations in South Asia, it would make things a lot easier, because actually the last time India tried to get on as an elected, as a non-permanent member of the Security Council in 1996. It just got swamped. It thought it had all these votes lined up, but Japan went around and just did a lot better, partly probably for financial reasons, and people thought they're getting aid out of it. But frankly, India didn't come off as very popular in its own region. And if it's not being put forward by the Asian region, it's not going to be considered globally.
Yes, I agree that India has a lot to do to recover its moral authority in Asia as well as the developing world as a whole. It probably has been more concerned with questions of power than of principle of late. But I don't see an India-US anti-Islamic coalition to be a potential sort of reality. And that's because while I think India has left behind any unthinking anti-Americanism in its foreign policy, it will also not uncritically endorse U.S. policies which it deems to be short-sighted or ill-advised. And I think we need to make a distinction between the specific policies of particular administrations. You know, there are many policies of the current government of both India or the United States that one may not like. On the other hand, nobody would dream of saying that the United States ought not to be a permanent member of the Security Council.
Or you could spread that out and include China
and
France as well. I want to see if we can get some of our callers in. First to, where are we off to here? Chelsea, Massachusetts. Ernest's joining us. Hi, Ernest.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, my comment rather, maybe a comment phrase in the form of a question, is that over the entire history of the United Nations and the Security Council, the U.S. has used the veto more than any country, you know, any other one with a veto power. But this is what I am afraid of. If you look at it currently, Russia is no longer as strong as the Soviet Union was. So it's now it's like the United States stands by itself as a superpower, and then you have the second-tier nations, even though they have a veto power, but they don't exercise it. So the Security Council has been reduced to what looks like an arm of the foreign policy of the United States, whereby only actions that are sanctioned by the United States can be carried out. Nothing can be accomplished if the United States...
Why couldn't you say the same thing about China, that nothing can be carried out unless it's sanctioned by China, because China has the same veto at that table?
I know, but if you look at the exercise of the veto, the United States has used it more than everybody else.
Right.
So therefore, it is bogged down, especially when President Bush says that you're either with us or against us, which you force the rest of the world to look at world issues from an American perspective.
So, Ernest, are you saying that any reform needs to get rid of the veto for everyone?
No, but that at least, if, you know, extend the, you know, the right to question decisions to more than just the five members who were there. Give some other people a chance to influence decisions of the Security Council, not just those five members who, for their own personal reasons, can't stop whatever goes on anywhere around the world.
Ed Luck, what is the 2003 rationale for keeping the veto, other than the fact that the five have had it and would like to keep it?
Well, first let me correct the historical record. The Soviet Union and Russia has cast far more vetoes than the U.S. has over history. It is true over the last 20 years the U.S. has cast more vetoes. But overall, the Soviet Union and now Russia has cast something like 120 vetoes and the U.S. 74. So the U.S. of the other four, certainly more than Britain, France, or China, but far less than Moscow has. Mm-hmm. But I think the argument in the U.S. initially, and among actually most member states, although India actually was represented and San Francisco was very much against the veto, but was that you needed to hold the five principal allies in the United Nations, which is what they called the alliance during the war, together, and you would need to have a veto to do this. Moscow would not possibly conceive of joining the UN without a veto because it knew it would be outnumbered otherwise. The U.S. didn't start using its veto until the 70s, but Congress really wanted to have the veto because otherwise they felt that American sovereignty might be might be somehow endangered. Right now, quite frankly, you asked in 2003, there is one dominant power in the world, and that's the United States. So if you were to redesign the charter based on power relationships, the U.S. might be the only one with the veto, or you might say, you know, no one should have a veto, in which case, quite frankly, a lot of major powers would ignore what the Security Council says. Because if the Security Council says that some major power must do this and that, unfortunately, there'd be no real power of enforcement, and it just wouldn't work. And, you know, we have to recognize that in the Charter, it says that among the criteria for membership of the non-elect of the elected members who actually have to campaign, the first should be their contributions to international peace and security. You can argue many ways what are the most important contributions, but one of them is the ability to, in fact, enforce the decisions of the Council. And most member states now seem to be very reluctant to do this, and have not kept their military forces to a position that they actually can project power. But, you know, other people may say, well, we should get away from that old idea of the UN, and it should all be about peace and love and law, which is great, but unfortunately it doesn't tell us very much about how you handle the Saddam Husseins or others who, in fact, flout international law and the decisions of the Council.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Back to the phones, and Sultan's joining us now from Salem, New Hampshire. Hi, Sultan.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I think I take this debate a little bit beyond, you know, this India issue or other African issue. I think it should be, this council should be more representative than other sensitivities. There's no Muslim representation. Actually, it's a quarter of the population in the world is a Muslim. It's always misunderstood. There's always a problem in the world. And there's no no input from, you know, from any presentation from their side of view. And so if there's any, it should be actually a larger Muslim country, maybe Indonesia, maybe Pakistan, maybe Egypt. There should be some representation of this mass population and where the most conflicts are.
There's also no one on the council from Africa. There's no one on the council from Latin America. Well, where do you draw the line? I'm not saying what your point is, that your point is wrong. I'm just saying how do you draw a line here?
Well, no, my you're taking it a different direction. I'm saying is as far as a group of people with one ideology, with one political concern, that is a Muslim as a Muslim nation, as a Muslim population. So, but as far as African, I have no problem with the representation, but represented by, in a faith-wise or in a kind of concern-wise, sensitivities-wise, by four already members of Security Council. But there's no representation from a Muslim point of view that what these people are, who they are, and the most of the conflicts are related to Muslim, unfortunately, these days, and in the past and maybe in the future. But there's nobody there to interact with and to say, well, you know, this may be not this. So otherwise,
okay, Sultan,
quote unquote terrorism. Everybody's, you know, kind of a one definition of terrorism, one definition of liberation movement, one definition.
Sultan, I'm going to let Shugata in here.
You know, I accept the general point that voices from the Islamic world need to be heard in international fora and the United Nations. But, you know, I think we ought not to privilege the religious affiliation in thinking about permanent members of the Security Council. In fact, I was a bit troubled when I read one portion of the Thomas Friedman article in the New York Times in which he described India as the largest Hindu nation in the world and the second largest Muslim nation in the world, as if that would be one of the grounds for India's admission. I was troubled because, you know, in that case, if you follow the logic of that argument, you would have to reduce the number of Christian nations, quote-unquote, that have seats currently. Mm-hmm. One would have to think about Indonesia as the largest, quote-unquote, Muslim nation as a candidate for this seat. I think that, you know, a much better argument, for example, for a country like India, is that it is, in fact, a very diverse country with a strong, flawed but functioning democracy. And in fact, it's precisely a turn towards Hindu majoritarian nationalism that poses the greatest threat to the quality of India's democracy today. So I think we ought to not think in terms of the religious identity of the majority of people in a country as a qualification or a disqualification for a permanent seat in the Security Council. We ought not to be privileging the religious distinction in that way.
And Ed Luck,
could I add a factual point here?
Yeah.
It is true that there is no Islamic country as a permanent member, but the Arab bloc is always represented on the council. Currently, it's Pakistan. In the last term, it was Syria. So there is it's not in the charter, but in the rules and the way that these countries are elected to the council, there is always a representative from the Arab bloc.
It seems to me, though, the flaw that we're talking about here that may exist in trying to design some kind of new Security Council is responding to today's current affairs. It was the Cold War. It was designed for that in mind. If we're talking today about tension that involves the Islamic world and you design a Security Council for that, it's going to be different in 20 years. How do you overcome that?
It is very difficult, and I think Professor Bowes made a good point before that regimes change in individual countries, their orientation changes, and so one needs some sense of a longer-term perspective on this. But unfortunately, these are chosen by political means, and member states vote in terms of who ought to be on the council, whether there ought to be amendments to the charter to change the makeup of the council, based on current realities. It may be that they ought to take a long-term perspective, but it's very rare that they do. And I do think, for all of its flaws, the founders of the UN, when they put together the council, when they put together the organization generally, really were quite far-sighted. And they managed to put together an institution that survived the Cold War, which did not, in fact, have the kind of world to operate in that they thought they were going to have, these five unified countries, and now has survived the post-Cold War era. And it has a lot of problems and a lot of up and downs and a lot of things that need improvement. But I think they did have some foresight. And I think, quite frankly, with the politics that we have today, any redesign is probably going to produce a weaker council rather than a stronger one. And I think we should judge it not by who's on it, but by what it does.
All right, Connection listeners, is the Security Council due for an overhaul? What sort of changes would you like? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the Security Council because certainly these days all our eyes are on that organization and the task that's ahead of it, starting this Friday and for the days after that in making an immediate determination about weapons inspections and the possibility of war and a second resolution. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. With me in the studio, Shougata Bose. He's Gardner Professor of History and Chairman of the Committee on South Asian Studies at Harvard. Edward Lux joining us from New York. He's a professor at Columbia University and has worked on UN reform as a senior consultant to the Department of Administration and Management at the United Nations. And Ed, I'll just get you to pick up where you left off going into the break, because when you say it's less who and more what the mission of the Security Council is or should be, is that what drives the conversation about reform, or is it very much about which nation gets to join the club?
Well, I'd like to say that the debate was all about how to make the council work better in the maintenance of international peace and security. But unfortunately, 95% of the conversation is about why this country deserves a spot or that deserves a spot. And, of course, most countries are pushing themselves. And so it's not a very edifying, deep kind of conversation, unfortunately. And the great discussion is equity. And that somehow equity in the council produces a more legitimate, a more effective council, as opposed to a council that does a better job at the maintenance of international peace and security. And I think, you know, if we sat down, any of the three of us, and decided to design a council, we probably could design a better one. But the problem is, when you have to negotiate through this political minefield, I haven't seen any solution, quite frankly, that I think would produce a better council than what we have now. I mean, I've watched this last 4 or 5 months of debate over Iraq, and I think, you know, what would happen if 10 countries had the veto? Because under the Razali proposal, we would have had 10 permanent members, but 5 with the veto and 5 without. If you had 10 vetoes, we could be talking from now until doomsday and still not come to a resolution.
You made a reference to Razali?
Razali Ismail from Malaysia was the president of the General Assembly in 96-97, and I worked with him on designing his his plan for the council. Which, by the way, also dealt a great deal with the working methods of the council, because it doesn't matter just who's sitting there or how the votes are organized. It also matters how open the council is, whether non-governmental groups and others have a voice in their debates, how many debates are what they call informal or secret, how many are public or formal. And there's a lot of questions about its relationship to the General Assembly, the International Court of Justice, the Secretary General, what kind of advice it gets, what kind of staffing it has. So there's a lot of questions about how the council works. One of the important questions is who sits on it, but that's not the only important question.
Sure.
But, you know, the ability to act swiftly and unanimously ought not to be the only criterion by which we ought to judge the efficacy of the Security Council. You know, a council should have a membership which would enable it to deliberate, you know, in a very serious way about the implications of choosing between war and peace. Now, I know that there's a lot of acrimony right now between the United States and France, but there would be many people in the world who would say that France is, in fact, providing a voice of sanity, which partly flows from its better understanding of the Middle Eastern region, which in turn perhaps partly flows from its, you know, colonial past. But do we have to entirely rely on countries like Britain and France, which have had extensive colonial empires, to bring some knowledge of places like Asia and Africa into the deliberations of the Security Council? You know, why not let, you know, representative members of the developing world come to the Security Council, you know, put forth their view in a weighty kind of way that they would be able to if they were permanent members? Because I think it's extremely important to think carefully about what kind of interventions, military or otherwise, peacekeeping or humanitarian, are likely to work in places like Northeast Asia or the Middle East, or for that matter, Africa. And for that reason, I think, you know, we might have a better Security Council which deliberates more carefully on these matters, rather than simply have a council which will just go along with whoever happens to be the only superpower at the moment.
1-800-423-8255 to Louisville, Kentucky. Pam's joining us. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I happen to agree with what's being talked about right now. I don't think the General Assembly needs to be revamped. And I think the only reason why we're talking about it is because they're offering opposition to the United States. I think somebody has to stand up to us. I think somebody has to show that they have the muscle to make President Bush listen. I think the makeup of the General Assembly and the Security Council is perfect the way it is. And if they hadn't spoken up, no telling what may happen. But I really think that they're offering the opposition that needs to be said right now.
Now, Pam, tell me, the folks in Washington have let it be known that if they don't like what they're hearing from the Security Council, they may just bypass whatever happens there. What do you think that says about the United States in the global community? Do you think that really matters?
I think it should matter. Now, whether it does or not is a different question, but I think it should matter. We're at the lowest point in our history. We're hated by just about everybody in the world. Bush will not listen to anyone else in the world, and whether if they bypass it, it just shows that he has no regard for anyone but himself.
And if he stays with the Security Council, if he gets a second resolution, Does that give you the sense of satisfaction that the international organization is working the way it should?
It only says that he's going to stop and take a breath and proceed the way he's going to proceed anyway.
He's not going to win any points from you, is he?
Not a one.
It's Ed Luck, it's an interesting moment where you have people within the administration saying, in effect, give us our view of the world or consider yourself irrelevant. But I don't think really it's the first time that's been said, is it?
No. I mean, the U.S. has had an ongoing ambivalence towards international institutions and international law, at least for the last 100 years, and then with the League of Nations as well as with the U.N. But I think the president does have a point. I happen to be a Democrat, and I don't sympathize with him on most things. But these resolutions and these decisions were not U.S.-dictated resolutions. These are decisions by the Security Council as a whole, going back to April 1991 with 687. And they laid down, under Chapter 7, which are supposed to be enforceable and which all member states under the Charter are supposed to follow, a series of requirements for Iraq that have never been met. Now, one may or may not agree with the U.S. Sense that military force is the way to do this, but I haven't seen any other plan that makes any sense. And so I think what's at stake here is the credibility of the council. Because if you're going to have a council that's just going to pronounce a lot of things, pass a lot of resolutions, but have neither the capacity nor the will to implement them, it's going to have no credibility. What you're going to have is another League of Nations. And in fact, if you look back to the final debate in the League of Nations, April 9th to 12th, 1946, when they're giving the mantle over to the UN, and you read what those people said, who were the representatives at the leagues, and these are not Americans because the U.S. never joined the league. They said, thank God we, one, have an organization that would not have complete equity of membership, that will allow the major powers to have more say, and that will have the real capability of using force when necessary in order to protect the international peace and security. And I'm afraid that some of what I've seen in the council recently, and I think France is among those, it's simply anything not to have a war. And I think what that does, one, it lessens the credibility of the council's own decisions because it shows the council's not willing to enforce them. And two, it just leads Saddam Hussein to figure, well, these guys are divided and weak, and I can ignore them and keep doing it. And others are going to learn those same lessons. So, you know, we can say that we want a council that doesn't, that isn't dominated by the U.S. I think that's fine. But, you know, if the U.S. is casting so many vetoes, it obviously isn't dominating the council. And all the other views are being held. And the debates in the council over something like Iraq have scores of member states giving speeches and commenting, not just even the members of the council. So, you know, I think that we have to be realistic, and we can set the council up on some Mount Olympus and pretend that somehow it's being relevant. But unless it has some relationship to power realities and realities in the world outside of the council walls, I think it would just be another League of Nations.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Shugata Bose, the League of Nations failed to prevent the Second World War, and that was the end of it. Can you see a time when the United Nations, in its current shape, is actually, at least from the Security Council point, I'm not going to talk about all the other things that it's doing well around the world, but becomes irrelevant because it's not taking account of the power relationships in the world and needs to be reconstituted, torn apart and completely rebuilt?
Well, it's always very hard to build something completely sort of de novo. You know, we keep hearing about how the United States had been setting the agenda for the United Nations and so on, yet the current quote-unquote crisis, where France appears to have taken a different point of view, seems to suggest that it's possible to have a multiplicity of views expressed in the Security Council. And I think, you know, France represents the point of view that a more stringent inspections regime might, in fact, be sufficient to defang Saddam Hussein.
But Professor Luck is saying, you know, there is that dozen resolutions sitting there unenforced, unobeyed.
True enough, but I think that members of the Security Council, I think, also need to ponder the question after a war, what? You know, is military action going to throw the entire region and the world into turmoil for years to come? I mean, these are issues that I think a Security Council ought to be thinking about. You know, the United States would undoubtedly win a war very quickly against Iraq, but then what is a question that a Security Council ought to be considering. And for that, I think voices from the developing world would be extremely important. Partly, you know, we are really, faced with a scenario where, you know, the United States will have to decide over the medium term, is it going to deploy its soft power within a multilateral mm-hmm. framework, or is it going to exercise its hard power unilaterally? And I think that, you know, this is something that divides, you know, intellectuals, scholars, even policymakers in the United States. You know, the current administration has taken a particular point of view, but it is something that I'm sure will be debated in the United States as well.
And Ed, like, I know that from living in the developing world, that a lot of the people there see the United Nations as an opportunity to redress the balance of power, to give them some kind of collective voice. And even that is not regarded as the way the UN could work or should work by those that have the power now.
Well, certainly the Security Council needs to find a happy medium between simply being an expression of the most powerful countries and, on the other hand, pretending that it's some kind of a global parliament, which it's not. It needs to recognize that the biggest shift since the end of the Cold War has been that other countries have not been keeping up their military capabilities, and the U.S. has. A percentage of our GNP or percentage of our budget, in fact, our military spending has fallen, but compared to others, we are the last superpower. Now, how does the U.N. respond to that? How can you design an international architecture for decision-making that somehow recognizes that, yes, one country has accumulated a lot more power and has much more capacity to enforce decisions of the Council than others do, and yet it has to listen to everybody else. And you need both. And it's a very hard thing to design. And whether one can do it by trying to move seats and names around in the Council, or whether it's really the question about the way it acts, the way its working methods, and what input different groups have in its decisions, it's a very, very tough time for the Council. And so I think that's a good time to be raising questions like whether India should be on, whether we should redress the balance.
I have to stop you there. We're out of time. Professor Luck, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Edward Luck, Director of the Center on International Organization at Columbia University. Shougata Bose, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Professor Bose, South Asian History at Harvard University. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.